Good mornings. I'm Chris Oakes, and coming up today, Findlay paying its final respects to the late councilman, auditor, mayor, economic development director, and flood mitigation champion, Tony Iriti. Also this morning, Senator John Husted joins us to discuss the 21st Century Road to Housing Act, which passed with broad bipartisan support this week on Capitol Hill, but is now being held up by the president. The senator will also share details of his recently introduced bill aimed at keeping private businesses private. And we have a star-spangled collection of special America 250 recipes from Kyra's Kitchen. This is the Good Mornings Podcast Edition for Friday, June 26th, 2026. Billboard Magazine is out with a list of the greatest R&B groups of all time. Earth, Wind, and Fire, number one. Earth, Wind, and Fire, the number one R&B group of all time. They are followed by The Temptations, Sly and the Family Stone, The Isley Brothers, and The Supremes. Really hard to argue with any of those in the top five. Billboard Magazine, an authority on music, and they have been for more than a century. And it's hard to argue with any of those. The rest of the top 10 is a little shaky, though. New Edition, Boys to Men, The Jackson 5, and Destiny's Child. The rest of the top five, they're a little shaky there. I mean, I'm not sure that you could put New Edition above, let's say, the Four Tops or Smokey Robinson, the Miracles. Jackson 5, absolutely. Boys to Men, okay. But there are an awful lot of other great R&B groups that I would probably put ahead of New Edition or even Destiny's Child. Anyway, discuss amongst yourselves. Thought it was interesting. And that's what we're here to do, share some of the most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your Friday morning started. The first things that you need to know this morning, America 250, our 250th birthday, are just a week away now, and the U.S. Mint is celebrating with the release of New Quarters series featuring the Declaration of Independence, an event held at Monticello earlier this week to help publicize the new quarters. The Mint also announced that 250,000 quarters bearing a special July 4th mark will be mixed in with the other Declaration of Independence quarters that are placed into circulation. Wow. So 250,000 for the 250th birthday with a special mark. Those will be collectibles. Those will be collectibles. And they are found out in the wild. The director of the Mint, Paul Hollis, said he hoped these special coins would help Americans reflect on their own history during this year's anniversary celebrations. Reflect on how much you can't buy with a quarter anymore. How about that? That's what... quarters featuring the Declaration of Independence. I don't know that it's a series of quarters. It says New Quarters featuring the Declaration of Independence. When they say quarters, plural, is that because there's a series of them that are all different, or because they're just making a bunch of quarters with the Declaration of Independence? I don't know. But in any event, be looking for those if you are a coin collector, or if you just like collecting cool stuff in conjunction with the 250th birthday of the United States. Speaking of things that you can't afford with a quarter anymore, a record number of cities, this is according to a new Zillow report, a record number of cities across the U.S. now have starter homes that are valued at $1 million or more. Record number of cities are that $1 million starter home list. I guess there were only 50 some odd cities on that list just a few years ago, and now it is up to 242 cities across 26 states that have housing markets with that $1 million price tag as the entry point to home ownership. That number, they point out, has tripled since the pandemic. California has the most cities on the list, probably not surprising. 105 cities in California have starter homes of $1 million or more. The second state on that list is New York. 42 cities in the Empire State have that reached that plateau. New Jersey, Florida, and Massachusetts round out the top five of the most cities that have $1 million starter homes. The good news is that Ohio has no cities on the $1 million starter home list. And more good news, a typical homeowner now breaks even compared to renting after roughly 6 years as compared to 8 years in 2023. So the value is there. And the value is getting better for homeowners versus renters. But the price, as we know, is just skyrocketing. Even though we don't have any cities on the $1 million starter home list, you know, it is getting more and more unaffordable for lots of families to get into that first home. Now, again, the Zillow report goes on to say it should be noted that a $1 million starter home is not the norm. The average home price across the country is just under $200,000 for a starter home. And I think we're above that locally. I would say it's pretty, I mean, we have some homes in our area that are in that under $200,000 range, but they're becoming harder and harder to come by. Every passing year. Of course, there is that big housing bill that Congress passed earlier this week that now has been stonewalled by the president. We're going to talk a little bit more about that with Senator John Husted on the program this morning. But I did think that was interesting. That list came out from Zillow in that week that the big housing bill passed Congress. So a lot of people say it doesn't maybe necessarily do enough to help struggling first-time home buyers, but it's a start. And a couple of other items here among the first things you need to know this morning, the most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day. We knew this was coming, and now it has happened. Apple is increasing its prices with the company's online store reflecting the new prices on Apple products yesterday. New prices hit. In a statement, the company attributed the rapid expansion of AI data centers in creating an extraordinarily huge surge in demand for memory chips and storage chips. They went on to say that we have never seen the price of any component increase this much this quickly. And to this point, they've been holding the line on prices, but now they're left with no choice. The price of an 11-inch iPad Air, now it was $599, it's up to $749. So $150 price increase on the iPad Air. And 11-inch iPad Pro is up $200 from $999 to $1199. And wow, $1,200 for a tablet. 13-inch MacBook Air was just over $1,000, $1,099. It's up $200 to $1,299. And the 14-inch MacBook Pro is now a whopping $1,999, $2,000. That's a $300 price increase. And even the price of the new budget MacBook Neo, which hit the market earlier this year and took off like a rocket. I have one of those, as a matter of fact, myself. Bought one when they were just released. And that also has gone up. I'm glad I bought it when I did. It's gone up $100 to a starting price of $699 from $599. Now, the good news is the price of an iPhone has not changed for now. But again, it's probably only a matter of time. So if you are in the market or you are thinking maybe here in a few months you might be in the market for a new iPhone, now might be the time to pull the trigger. Of course, you know, the other thing you can do is wait. In the fall, they'll have new ones out, because they always do, but expect them to cost a little bit more than they have in the past. And lastly here, among the first things that you need to know, the most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day, you're going to have a movie night this weekend. Maybe you go to the movies, maybe you stay at home and pop some popcorn and take in a movie at home, Netflix or whatever. Be on the lookout for the product placements. Nearly half of U.S. adults say they notice brands in movies and TV shows. They say they always or often can spot these product placements, companies that pay for their products to be visibly seen on the screen. And in the past, it's kind of been subtle, but it is becoming more and more obvious. Now more than half of U.S. adults say that they can immediately spot these product placements. Food and beverage brands are the most visible, followed by automotive brands. Younger viewers are particularly observant. 53% of those between 18 and 34 say they frequently notice product placements, compared to just 39% of adults over the age of 55. Because we're just not paying as much attention to this. 2 in 5 say that product placement has become more blatantly obvious in recent years, but a majority admit that it is effective advertising for these products. Consumer engagement follows. 44% admit that they have taken action after seeing a brand on screen. 1 in 5 will search for the product. 1 in 10 will actually make a purchase. And that's why they do it. But so the next time you're watching a movie, maybe this weekend, something to think about there. As you're enjoying a film. There you go. Some of the most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your Friday morning started.
I'm Jay Fox on the Ohio News Network. In Southwest Ohio, the U.S. Supreme Court decision to allow the end of temporary protected status for Haitians and others has the city of Springfield in an uproar, as the decision allows for the immediate deportation of more than 15,000 immigrants and their families. Protests have begun, and Governor Mike DeWine called the move a mistake. The impact could be devastating to families, the community, and the economy. In Northeast Ohio, a home explosion in Twinsburg Township was so powerful that it destroyed 3 houses and damaged as many as 20 others on a cul-de-sac. The blast triggered a shelter-in-place order and 2 hospitalizations. In Central Ohio, 31-year-old Alex Morris, the Mansfield father wanted for the murder of his 3-year-old child, was captured and arrested in Morrow County yesterday, concluding a 2-year manhunt. In Northwest Ohio, community leaders are pushing back on a proposed first energy rate hike that they say is a fallout from the House Bill 6 scandal. Rates would increase over 3 years, resulting in as much as $16 per month more by 2029. In Southeast Ohio, flood watches have been issued for the majority of the region, as saturated ground conditions mean the heavy rains forecasted for today and tomorrow will cause localized flooding. The ONN weather team has issued a heat advisory for the entire state, with excessive heat building Tuesday through Thursday, pushing daytime highs into the upper 90s. For the Ohio News Network, I'm Jay Fox.
The ONN Daily Podcast. Get a recap of all the day's news from across the state.
ONN affiliate WBNS-TV in Columbus has more.
Haley Kirby, reporting in downtown Toledo.
From the State House, Kevin Landers.
ONN Canton.
ONN affiliate WKYC-TV in Cleveland explains.
In Marietta, Brett Wharf, ONN News.
Emma Henderson in Genoa.
The ONN Daily Podcast. Listen at onnradio.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts from the Ohio News Network.
So later this afternoon, the city of Findlay will hold a memorial for the late councilman, auditor, mayor, economic development director, and flood mitigation champion, Tony Iritti, who passed away recently. Current Finley Mayor Christine Murn is with us this morning. And it is hard to understate how influential Tony Iriti was in so many different roles. His imprint on the community is everywhere.
Yeah, definitely. He left a huge legacy and, you know, really proud that he was such a champion for our community and will be dearly missed, but really grateful for all that he did in the community, a true public servant over the years.
I look back, I was thinking about this when we heard the news that he had passed, and I would be hard-pressed, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find another individual who, certainly in the modern day, who had more influence on what Findlay, the type of community that Findlay is today, than Tony Iriti. Again, you think of all of the different roles that he played and all of the different ways that he touched the community. I mean, can you think of anyone who had a greater impact on where we are today?
Oh my gosh. I would agree. You know, one of the things that made him so successful in his leadership in the city of Findlay is, and for the entire county, was that he had a vision and brought people together and then was relentless at getting that done. You know, that sometimes upset people, which I can certainly relate to. But I think he was really one that said, we are somewhere special, and a special place deserves the best, and that, you know, let's achieve it.
And that is an interesting facet of it, too, because that love for the community did not come from him being a native in the community. We all have a soft spot for the place that we were born and the place that we grew up and our quote unquote hometown. But Tony was not a Findlay native. He came in to the community and saw that possibility as kind of an outside observer that grew to love the community for, he saw the potential.
Definitely. And I think that, you know, makes it even more special, right? Because he was someone who said, this is a special place, recognize that as, you know, a quote unquote, you know, outsider.
Right.
And then made this his home, and how he could continue to help make it a special place. And, you know, the vision, like you mentioned, with flood mitigation, really setting that up and setting us on a good path, bringing in key community leaders, like, you know, executives from Marathon and Cooper and the overall, the Heminger family, and saying, we have to work together to get this done, and really set that course. And then, you know, trust as he handed it off to the next generation of leaders to have set that course for us. And, you know, we're, as we talk so much, you know, today in you know, about flood mitigation, he's definitely left his imprint on that.
Is that maybe the biggest thing when you think about Tony Iriti's legacy and what you remember most about his time in the community and all of the things that he did, is that ability to bring people together? And certainly that served him well as mayor, as head of the Flood Mitigation Partnership. Economic development certainly is largely about relationships, but he certainly did have that opportunity to bring people together and drive them toward that common goal.
Yeah, I think so. You know, especially when with economic development, right? He was kind of the one that shaped the Findlay formula, and bringing folks together and recognizing that coalition building is so key, that government can't do it alone, that the business community can't do it alone, that education or the nonprofit, kind of those two are interchangeable depending on the issue. Can't do it alone. So how do we make sure that we're all rowing in the same direction? And I think we take that for granted so often in Findlay because it is a part of who we are and how we operate. But if we think back, you know, 20, 30 years ago, that wasn't always the case. And it's definitely not the case in other communities. So I think that's certainly a part of his legacy. But, you know, as mayor today, I still look at documents. I, you know, have the vision document from the strategic plan that they kind of put together. And it's cool to look back and see, you know, the Performing Arts Center was a part of that vision. The Cube Recreation Complex was a part of that vision. Looking at combining the health departments was something that was identified. And so not only did he have the gumption to kind of pull people together and say, what do we want our community to look like in 10, 20, 30 years and be relentless at pushing that vision, but then truly, you know, we made it happen and we are now seeing the results of that. And then in economic development, if we think back, you know, 15 years ago, all the companies that have been brought in, whether it was under Tony's leadership or Tim Miley's or Dan Schaefer's and, you know, the folks that we've had recently, I think our community looks way different in really positive ways. And so I'm really grateful because they set us up for success and I keep continuing to lead on that premise.
It's interesting. You're talking about, you still see his name and his signature on things because I was going to ask, I mean, what from his leadership, I mean, looking back, I'm sure that you can appreciate even more now that you are in the role of mayor. And I'm wanted to ask, what do you take away from, what lesson from Tony, either directly or indirectly, something that maybe you got from Tony directly or something that you have kind of absorbed in reflecting and learning more about everything that he did when he held that role?
Yeah, you know, I think being relentless champion for the city of Findlay and recognizing that, you know, some decisions are going to be unpopular, but when you know it's the right thing for the community, continuing to drive in that direction, making sure that you're bringing people along and trying to, making sure that when I'm moving forward, that I have all of those other key stakeholder support in the vision that we're wanting to move towards, right? So meeting with the economic development and the business community and our school leadership and the university leadership and community foundation, bringing all those people together to keep pushing issues is certainly something that I have ingrained in my practice. And, you know, whether it was under Tony or Lydia, you know, I was really grateful to have both of them as people that I could call and speak with and learn from both. You know, sometimes it was, yeah, don't do that. That didn't go well. I'll learn from my mistakes. And, you know, certainly I bring a different approach at times. But I certainly rely on the legacy that they've built to continue to push.
And as you mentioned, Tony was not without his critics. There were those who disagreed with some of those decisions that he made or directions that he took. I think of example of flood mitigation. He was criticized for relying too heavily on the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. And subsequently, the community did move in a different direction with that. Again, we can still debate whether that delayed the process or not. But like you said, he did what he felt was right, but at the same time was at least open to discussing that. Again, this is something that you are not unfamiliar with yourself, and making some of those big decisions, that's what kind of comes along with it.
Yeah, that's the seat, right? In public service, in a position of elected, people always think that you know, that they know more or have a different view of things, and that's totally fine. And I think trying to explain why you're doing things a certain way, and I think we all learned, you know, the Army Corps of Engineers was the government entity that he was supposed to work with. And so I can't fault him at all for that, but I think we all learned a lot on on the challenges of doing that. But I think, you know, beyond just his professional work, he is a great guy and, you know, very dedicated. Tonight, we're going to talk a little bit about his love for music and the arts and how his legacy is going to continue to support those things as well.
Yeah, he was just beyond all of the terrific and lasting impact he had on the community. He was just a great guy. And, you know, we shouldn't, anyone who knew him even casually would tell you that. So memorial is this evening at Dorney Plaza, right? Real quickly, give us the details on this.
Yep, 5:30 at Dorney Plaza. There's going to be a variety of speakers. It's in Dorney Plaza, unless, you know, if it starts to rain, then we're going to be inside in city council chambers.
Okay.
And it's really a celebration of life, just a little reflection. The family, a couple family members are going to be there. And it's just an opportunity for us to come together and recognize, you know, his impact on our community. And it's, you know, crazy that he's gone. And I'm disappointed. I actually have invited all of the living mayors to attend and walk with me in the 4th of July parade. And so I had actually just recently been speaking with him about having him attend that. So it's really sad. But I think as we look around the community, it's a time for us to just appreciate his impact and share that love with his family.
It is a legacy that will be felt for a long, long time in Findlay and Hancock County. And Findlay Mayor Christina Mern, thanks very much for taking the time, sharing your thoughts. We appreciate it.
Of course. Great to see you, Chris.
Well, no, you're not going crazy. Originally, we had planned on talking with Senator John Husted yesterday on the program, but a change in the Senate schedule means that we had to shuffle that schedule a little bit. Glad to have Senator Husted with us this morning on the program. What's that old saying about a day late and a dollar short? Hopefully, we're still okay on that. Senator, thanks very much for taking the time to join us. We appreciate it.
Great to be with you.
It was a big week in Congress. The 21st Century Road to Housing Act sailed through both chambers, both the House and Senate, passed it with an overwhelming majority. I know you voted for the measure. How disappointed were you when the president decided yesterday not to sign the bill?
Well, I think he'll ultimately sign it. I think it's just a delay. He was really trying to get. He was unhappy about some of the votes on the Iran war issue right in the middle of negotiations. I think we remedied that. We supported his attempt to make sure that the Strait of Hormuz remains open, to make sure that Iran does not have a nuclear weapon, and to get gas prices down, and to hopefully end the threat of the state, the largest state sponsor of terrorism, Iran. It's been around for the last 47 years. So once we got with him on the same page on that, I think that now ultimately he will sign the bill, but he hasn't of yet. But he'll get there. And this bill's good because it's going to open up more capital investment in housing, which creates more supply to meet the demand, which will help to hold down the prices of housing. Ohio is one of the states that actually is one of the most affordable places to buy a home. We want to keep it that way and keep Ohio the heart of it all, where people can still pursue the American dream.
I thought it was interesting. Newsweek had a piece looking at the states that will be most and least impacted by this. And not surprisingly, the states that would be most impacted are the really expensive housing states, New York and California and Florida and such. And Ohio is listed as one of the states where there would be probably the least impact. Although that being said, critics have
said, it's because Ohio is one of the more more affordable states. I think a few years ago, look at a recent thing. I think the Lima market, the Toledo market, up in Northwest Ohio are some of the most affordable markets in the whole country.
Yeah,
but you know, that doesn't mean it's there
that
for everybody. Some places need to have more construction. I know in rural places, like I grew up in rural Northwest Ohio, a lot of times rural communities are the ones that don't have an adequate supply of housing. And why is that? Because it's not expensive. And so home builders don't like to build there because they can't make as much money on selling a house.
It is a fair
rural
point.
Community, so we don't have as much construction. And so, you know, there's just different things affect the housing market in different ways. And we have to look at, you know, a variety of ways to impact that.
And it's been, the point has been made that this is like the most substantive housing bill that is passed through Congress, come out of Congress in like 30 years. And yet some critics say that while they support the bill, that it doesn't do enough. Can more be done to address the affordability issue that so many families feel as though they can't afford to get into that first home?
So yes, more can be done, but a lot of that's at the state and local level. Regulations are, there was a report that came out that showed that $132,000 of the cost of a home in average across the country are as a result of regulations. So time is money. If you have a slow permitting process that takes you a long time, if you have high impact fees, for example, that some communities charge builders high impact fees for the extension of water and sewer lines, all those things are rolled up into the cost of a house, a home, an apartment building. Mm-hmm. And so the faster we go, the less regulations, the more that we can do to improve infrastructure. I could go on, you know, in terms of trying to change ways that we permit and regulate these things. All of those are costs. And so every little bit, Chris, goes into the cost of a home, and every little bit you take out reduces the cost.
Also want to switch gears here and talk about a bill that you recently introduced, and I think this is interesting and probably long overdue. It's called the Invest Act, and as we were teasing a little bit earlier, it's basically a bill aimed at keeping private businesses private. Explain what the Invest Act is and what it would do.
Well, I think most people are probably aware that President Trump has invested in certain industry sectors, a lot of it in computer chips, quantum computing, things like this. Why? Because we want to do more made in America, right? We want made in America. China is subsidizing industries that dump products in the American marketplace and make it hard for American businesses to compete. So what the president has done is he's made investments, took 10% of Intel, for example, and there are many other companies that have done that. Okay, I understand why, because you don't want to bail out a company and then let just their shareholders benefit from it and not the American taxpayer. So by making those investments and then keeping that equity, the American taxpayer can get the benefit from it. However, I am very uncomfortable with the idea of the federal government owning private companies for a long period of time. So I've introduced this legislation that would require the government to divest of those investments within 8 years, and that the money that the government makes off that goes to pay down the national debt. That's something that several things I feel strongly about.
Yeah.
But you also have people like Bernie Sanders who are out there saying that the government should take control of certain businesses. Whether you're on the political left or political right, American capitalism and America 250 has been the engine of prosperity for this nation. The idea that we would start to look more like China and having the government take more and more control of businesses makes me very uncomfortable. And so I understand to compete and to save some businesses from China gouging them, and dumping and undermining those businesses, that the government may have to play a role on occasion, but I don't want government permanently owning businesses, and this is aimed to stop that.
This is not necessarily something that started with Donald Trump. I mean, the United States government has taken a state or had an interest in businesses in the past, but with this president, it does seem to be, I guess, more strategic rather than through necessity. Do you delineate the difference between that?
I think it's frankly out of necessity. I mean, for example, I'll take the case of Intel. Mm-hmm. It's a company that was on the ropes, and that there was a government package called the Chips and Science Act,
right,
that was designed to give giant grants to these chip companies. Mm-hmm. What the president said, I'm going to convert those grants into equity. We're going to take an ownership stake in these companies. We will help them build their plants. We will help them make these strategic investments.
Right.
But instead of them being a grant in which the shareholders are the only ones that benefit, he wants the American taxpayer to benefit. Completely understand that. And sometimes that's a necessity, particularly when China is subsidizing businesses that compete against American businesses. However, I don't want it to be permanent.
Right.
I want there to be a requirement that you divest and that then we do something that's in the long-term interest of America by paying down the national debt.
And were you rather surprised to find out that there was no rule or regulation that has required this in the past? Because it does seem like that would be a no-brainer, that the government should not be taking an ownership stake for an infinite period of time.
Well, I have to admit that I thought that there would be more of an uprising, kind of a conversation about this. I thought, you know, I'm the newest member of the Senate. I thought, well, surely one of the senior senators will introduce legislation to do this.
Surely, this
and no one did. Yeah. So I said, fine, I've got to do this. I just couldn't rest my head on the pillow at night knowing that nobody was doing anything to try to set this straight. And so that's what I decided.
And real quickly, what has been the reaction since you introduced this? This has a ways to go until it, you know, hopefully becomes law. But what has been the reaction, the feedback?
I've had overwhelmingly positive reaction to it because it's, look, I don't care what side of the political aisle you're on. Mm-hmm. There, in this politics today, I think we have a great distrust of government, right? Whether you're on the political left or the political right. And,
right.
I think people largely have agreed with me on from all sectors to say, yeah, this is probably not a very good idea. Because if you're on the political left, the idea of Donald Trump owning a company, you know, sends chills for you. If you're on the political
right,
the idea of Bernie Sanders or AOC or Elizabeth Warren owning, being the president and doing this makes you nervous. So let's all recognize that this is not how America does things. It's a necessity out of circumstance right now, but we don't want it to become a permanent part of how government works.
We will leave it there for now. Again, Senator John Husted, thanks very much for taking the time this morning. We appreciate it.
Great to be with you.
This is Good Mornings with Chris Oakes on 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and 95.5 FM.
In the news business, there are two separate and distinct groups: breaking news and the news that is already broken. These are their stories.
Now, this first item today is not necessarily an odd or unusual item, but it is alarming. Researchers at Rutgers University have discovered genetic mutations in rodents in New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Washington, D.C. What they found is that 5 out of 6 mice and rats carried genetic mutations, reducing the effectiveness of common exterminator poisons. What is that? And 7 in 10 carried mutations conferring full immunity to standard rodenticides, the things we use to kill these things, these pests. Researchers say house mice showed the most mutations, but sewer rats, which currently are less mutated, are catching up. How is this not the biggest story of the day? I mean, forget the war in Iran, forget high gas prices, earthquakes, hurricanes, tornadoes. We can survive all of that. We have mutant rats here that are immune from the, we can't kill them. How is this not the biggest story of the day? Apparently, researchers began investigating this about 5 years ago after pest control companies reported a decline in the effectiveness of their treatments. They want to know what's going on. Well, now we know. We have mutant mice and rats running around. That doesn't make you feel uncomfortable. I don't know what will. Elsewhere in the broken news, in Pasco County, Florida, a highway patrol trooper arrested a 34-year-old man earlier this month after discovering 34 open White Claw cans during a traffic stop. Connor Paraday of San Antonio, Texas, was pulled over for driving more than 90 miles an hour when his Honda Civic sped past the patrolling officer. The trooper determined that Mr. Paraday was heavily intoxicated during the stop. Probably determined that from the 34 open cans. Authorities found the beverage containers in the passenger seat. He was charged with driving under the influence and taken to the Pasco County Jail. 34. Sometimes people just make it a little too easy. You know what I mean? And finally, here in the broken news this morning, speaking of automotive fun, since 2011, Steve Braithwaite has been driving a car shaped like a giant banana. This unique vehicle recently caught the attention of the Montana Highway Patrol, which shared a photo of a traffic stop outside of Billings, saying, "We've stopped a few unusual vehicles, but this one definitely stands out. The big banana car may be appealing, but traffic laws still apply to fruit." Talk about a phrase you never thought you would actually hear a law enforcement officer say. Traffic laws still apply to fruit. Apparently, Mr. Braithwaite's license plate, which naturally reads Split, was obscured. He was given a warning and sent on his way. He says he is probably the most pulled over motorist in America, but driving the banana car is worth it. There you go. That is today's Broken News Report, an update on the odd and unusual side of the headlines. We now return you to your regularly scheduled programming.
Finley, get ready to rock for a cause. Join Flag City Honor Flight on Saturday, July 11th from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Finley Elks Lodge 75 for the Reunion Band Concert and Dance. Enjoy a fantastic evening of live music and dancing, all while supporting Flag City Honor Flight, a local organization helping veterans visit the memorials in Washington, D.C. that honor their service and sacrifice. Come out to 900 West Melrose Avenue. Let's show our veterans how much we appreciate them.
This message provided by WFIN.
And now your daily download, the numbers behind the news and the statistics that shape our lives. This is really interesting. YouGov is out with their latest Trust in Media survey. They're looking to see what are the most trusted news outlets in the country. And for 2026, the Weather Channel remains America's most trusted news source. That's 5 years running that the Weather Channel. What does that say about trust in media that the Weather Channel is the most trusted news outlet? After that, PBS and the Wall Street Journal are numbers 2 and 3, along with the BBC, the Associated Press, ESPN, and Reuters. So you can agree or disagree, but those are the ones that they rank at the top of their survey. Breitbart, One America Network, OAN, and Fox News rank as the least trusted overall. The average net trust in media has fallen from plus 9% last year to plus 6% this year. And that's basically the number of people who trust a news outlet minus the number of people who don't distrust as a percentage, and you subtract one from the other and you get either a net positive or a net negative number. And again, it really says something that overall we were at just plus 9 and now we're only at plus 6 in the media this year. CBS and MS Now, formerly MSNBC, is the rebranded MSNBC. Those are the two outlets that experienced the biggest year-over-year drop in trust, each falling 12 percentage points, while Fox News edges CNN in terms of the most popular specific news outlet. So again, interesting, Fox News ranked among the least trusted overall, but the most popular specific news outlet. Fox News edging CNN. CNN and Fox remain the most politically polarizing in the survey, with an 85% partisan gap. And we know which side prefers which, but not a big surprise there. Americans do say now that they get their news primarily from social media. That's probably not a surprise. That's where many of us get our news. Primarily from social media, even though social media platforms average a minus 15 in net trust. Minus 15. TikTok and Truth Social rank the lowest. of all of the social media outlets, and only 11% feel confident distinguishing AI-generated news from actual human-produced content. And yet, the majority of Americans get their news primarily from social media. But you can see the pitfalls that we recognize, but that's still where we get our news. Fascinating stuff in the YouGov Trust in Media Survey 2026. So as we mentioned earlier, I think we mentioned earlier on the program, we will not be here next Friday because it is the effective holiday.
Yeah. Federal holiday.
Yeah. Yeah. only in America can we take a holiday as sacred as our Independence Day.
Yes.
And move it.
Yes.
So that we get an extra day off, so we get a day off work.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's more American than that?
That's right.
Friday is the kind of de facto holiday since it actually falls on Saturday and you have to have a day off.
Yeah.
It's so
not fair.
It's the American way. Anyway, so this is the opportunity to share a star-spangled collection of special America 250 recipes from Kyra's Kitchen. That's the point, because we won't be here on Friday.
Right.
Next week, right before the holidays, so we want to share them today, special 4th of July recipes. And what could be more apropos for a star-spangled collection of recipes for America's independence? We have brats from Germany, we've got salsa from Mexico, and we've got Biscoff cookies from Belgium.
But this is also the World Cup, and it's
True.
And so that makes...
That's very true.
Yeah.
And what
just
is...
Just go with it, honey.
I was going to say, this is perfect, because what is America but a melting pot? And
that's
what do
right.
we do with all of these things? We put an American twist on them. So we're doing the brats in the slow cooker. We're adding watermelon to the salsa. And we're adding Rice Krispies to the Biscoff. We have Americanized all of these things. So let's start with the slow cooker beer brats and caramelized onions.
Yes. So this is one large sweet onion, a quarter cup of butter, two 12-ounce bottles of IPA beers. I just use Coors Light because
that's what we have.
That's what I drink. Yep. 12 brats, quarter cup of Dijon mustard, quarter cup of ketchup, 1 tablespoon apple cider vinegar, 1 tablespoon packed brown sugar, 1 teaspoon honey, 1 teaspoon Worcestershire sauce, 1 teaspoon lemon juice, quarter teaspoon paprika, 1/8 teaspoon garlic powder, salt and pepper to taste, and 1/4 teaspoon of hot sauce. If you don't want the hot, you don't have to put the hot in. So that's why that's at the bottom.
Okay.
So slice your onions into thick rings in a medium-sized pan. Saute onions in butter until softened, about 5 minutes. Remove onions from pan and place them in the bottom of your crock pot. Set pan aside. In a mixing bowl, combine Dijon mustard, ketchup, vinegar, brown sugar, honey, Worcestershire sauce, lemon juice, paprika, garlic powder, salt and pepper, and the hot sauce. Mix well and set aside. Add the sauce and brats to the crock pot on top of the onion and stir to combine. Pour beer over the top and cover. Turn the crock pot on low and cook for 6 to 7 hours.
That is great.
And then put them on a nice big bun.
Yeah.
Lots of carbs there.
Great stuff. To go along with that, we have a recipe for watermelon salsa. This is great finger food, for your 4th of July party and all of that.
Yes.
So watermelon salsa.
Yes. So 4 cups of finely chopped seedless watermelon, about a half inch cube for those, 2 jalapenos diced. I took the seeds out because I don't like a whole lot of heat.
Yeah.
If you want the heat, then keep the seeds in. 1 large shallot minced, 1/4 or 1/2 cup of cilantro chopped, 1 garlic clove minced, juice of 2 limes, kosher salt, and freshly ground pepper. So in a large bowl, combine the watermelon, the jalapenos, the shallot, cilantro, and garlic. Pour over the lime juice and stir to combine. Season to taste with your salt and pepper. Add a pinch of cayenne for some more heat if you want it.
So you're going to take the seeds out of the jalapenos and then add cayenne.
Well,
Or you can do both, I guess, if you really like it.
Or don't add the cayenne if you don't want any heat at all, if you want to keep it mild. So whatever your heart desires.
whatever level of hotness you want on this,
and serve with some tortilla chips.
There you go. All right.
And this one is actually, even if you let it sit for at least a couple hours, get those.
If not overnight.
Yeah,
this is another one of those.
Yeah,
let all of those flavors blend. So do that the day before for best results.
Yes.
And then for dessert, we have a recipe for Biscoff Rice Krispie Treats.
Yes. So this is 5 cups of rice cereal, 7 Biscoff cookies, 4 tablespoons of salted butter, 1/2 cup of cookie butter, and 10 ounces of marshmallows. So grease a large mixing bowl and an 8x9 or 9x9 inch square pan with butter or baking spray. Pour the Rice Krispie cereal into the bowl. Break up 6 of your Biscoff cookies and toss that with the cereal. Melt the butter and the Biscoff butter in a medium saucepan set over low heat. Add the marshmallows, stir it occasionally until everything is almost melted. Remove from the heat. Continue to stir, pressing down on the marshmallows until completely melted. Pour the melted marshmallows over the cereal and stir until well coated. Gently press the cereal mixture into your buttered 8x9 inch pan or 9x9, whatever size you have is fine. So it may just be a little bit thicker or a little bit thinner.
Yes.
So breaking up the remaining cookies into very small pieces, sprinkle that over the treats. Press the cookie crumbs down to make sure they kind of stick in there. Let them cool for at least 30 minutes before cutting into squares.
So when you break up those cookies, and I understand you really want to crumble them for the ones that you put on the top.
Yeah.
When you put the Biscoff cookies into the mix, how...
Still, just break them up. I mean, maybe more with a. I used a rolling pin, but I didn't make them crumbs. I still had there were still chunks in there. She want like good chunks of the cookie.
Decent sized chunks. We don't want. Yeah. One huge guy. No. I was just thinking,
definitely don't use a food processor on this. I mean, you want those chunks of cookies.
Them.
No.
Yeah. Yes. No, and I suppose it really doesn't matter because this is one of those like the pan size of the pan. It really doesn't matter.
Right.
I mean, you can make them on a cookie sheet if you want.
Oh yeah.
It just changes the thickness of it. So it's whatever you prefer.
Correct.
Because it's not like you're cooking these.
Right.
And so, those types of things don't matter. But I just wondered, what your thoughts were on, the size of the.
But hey, if you like them nice and crumbly, then go for it. Yeah, I don't recommend it. I like having that crunch of the cookie in with my Rice Krispie treat.
You should know they're in there.
Yeah.
I mean,
For sure.
That's the whole point.
Yes.
Otherwise, why even bother?
Yeah.
So the recipes for the slow cooker beer brats and caramelized onions, the watermelon salsa, and the Biscoff Rice Krispie treats are all on the Kyra's Kitchen Facebook page, right?
Yep.
Okay, so you can go there and find those. We do have it linked up at our webpage as well at goodmornings.net. You can find it there. And again, we are off next Friday, so that's it for the recipes before Independence Day. You'll have to make these work. You got plenty of time to get out and get everything that you need.
Get everything taken care of.
All right, so good deal, and wish you a very happy 4th.
Yep.
My wife, Kyra, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
And that will finish up our podcast for today. I want to thank all of our guests for joining us on the program this morning. Remember, you can get more information about all of the topics we talk about each and every day on the program at our webpage. Once again, that is goodmornings.net. And if you're a regular listener to the podcast, we would also appreciate it if you would take a moment or two at some point to leave us a rating or review on your favorite podcasting platform. That will help others discover the show as well. Coming up Monday morning, are you ready for a road trip? Well, bring your appetite, because award-winning travel writer and Buckeye native Brandi Gleason will tell us where to find the most unique eats and eateries in Ohio. So until Monday morning, that is Good Mornings for this morning. Now that you've had a good morning, go on out and make it a good day, a great weekend. We'll catch you back here next week.